On the show today, Israeli forces leave Jenin.
Refugees International and other human rights groups have called on both the Israeli military and Palestinian militant groups to immediately cease escalatory violence.
Plus, election observers are headed back to Guatemala.
The move could potentially make way for a recount before a runoff vote set for next month. Sandra Torres, a former first lady on the center-right who won the first round, has alleged the votes were manipulated.
And later, a look at how polarized Americans really are, and we find out what South Korea learned when they pulled a North Korean reconnaissance satellite up from the bottom of the sea. Today is Thursday, July 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. It seems that Americans are more divided than ever, and, well, now there's some demographic evidence to back that up. That story in a few minutes. First, though, we go to the West Bank, where residents of the Jenin refugee camp are returning home after a two-day raid by Israeli forces that left 13 Palestinians and one Israeli soldier dead. Israel has pulled its forces out, but says it will conduct further operations if needed to eradicate terrorism. Meanwhile, Palestinian health officials accuse Israel of targeting hospitals. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Residents of the Jenin refugee camp found widespread damage when they returned from shelters or emerged from their homes early Wednesday after the Israeli military's largest-scale operation in the occupied Palestinian territory in almost 20 years. Israel's defense minister, Yoav Gallant, defended the raid, saying Israeli forces targeted terrorists.
They arrived at dozens of places where the terrorists from different organizations in Jenin had set up a factory of terror production. Charges, ammunition, various types of weapons. In fact, from this place, they sowed death throughout the West Bank and beyond the Green Line.
One expert told VOA that Jenin does have a long history of being a stronghold of Palestinian militant groups. Brian Katulis is vice president of policy at the Middle East Institute.
So what we see are militias that are not affiliated with some of the leading Palestinian factions, and they presented a severe threat to law and order. Not only a terrorist threat to Israelis, but also a challenge to ordinary Palestinian civilians. And this action, I think, was seen by some, the Israel Defense Forces action, as responding to some very legitimate threats.
The Palestinian health minister accused Israeli defense forces of attacking hospitals during the raid. Mai Al-Kaila is the Palestinian health minister.
Since the start of their attack, the occupation forces attacked the Jenin governmental hospital, seriously wounding citizens inside. The occupation forces also fired at Al-Hamal Hospital more than once, injuring a citizen inside. This afternoon, they also stormed the yard of Ibn Sina Specialized Hospital with armored vehicles. They also deliberately obstructed ambulances and their crew in Jenin and prevented them from reaching the wounded. The whole world witnessed the occupation forces shooting at ambulances and crews and preventing them from treating the wounded.
Refugees International and other human rights groups have called on both the Israeli military and Palestinian militant groups to immediately cease escalatory violence and especially any attacks on civilians, saying Israel's use of airstrikes against the densely populated Jenin refugee camp is both troubling and disproportionate. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Much of the tension in the West Bank is centered around new Jewish settlements on occupied land. The new right-wing Israeli government has sparked a building frenzy of these settlements, and the international community has called on them to stop. Linda Gradstein reports from the West Bank.
The small outpost community of Givat Harel is built on the outskirts of the West Bank Jewish settlement of Eili, where Palestinian gunmen killed four Israelis last month. Part of the Israeli government's response to the terrorist attack was the announcement that this and other nearby outposts will be legalized and that thousands of new homes will be built in the West Bank, which settlers call Judea and Samaria. Israel Gantz is the Binyamin regional governor.
In Judea and Samaria today lives 500,000 Jews. We will work hard to double it in 10 years. When I say we will work hard here in Binyamin, we plan, we have a city planning for more than 20,000 apartments, which means at least 100 more people.
Since its formation 6 months ago, Israel's hardline government has announced plans for massive expansion of Jewish settlements in the West Bank, built amid nearly 3 million Palestinians who claim the land for a prospective future state. Far-right Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, who also has authority over settlements within the defense ministry, has vowed to increase construction and has almost completely blocked the dismantling of illegal outposts, according to a recent report by the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Hardline National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir called on young Jewish settlers to respond to terrorist attacks by building new settlements anywhere they can. "We are backing you up," he said. "Run to the hills and settle. We love you." The international community says all this settlement construction inflames tensions in an already volatile situation. Tor Wennesland is the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process.
I remain deeply troubled by the relentless expansion of Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, that fuels violence and is impeding access to by Palestinians to their land and resources, reshaping geography on the occupied West Bank and threatening the viability of a future Palestinian state.
But the settlers say that development of this area should be viewed in the same way as the rest of Israel. Raful Engel is the Binyamin regional deputy governor. "This area is where our forefathers walked," Engel says. "It is part of the land of Israel." He says people live here the same way they live in Tel Aviv, Hadera, and Sfat. "And when you have life, you have development," he says. "People here have children, and we need to expand." Jewish settlers say this Israeli government has been the friendliest to their cause than any that preceded it. They hope that the far-right policies will finally put an end to talk of Israel withdrawing from the West Bank to create a Palestinian state. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Givat Harel in the West Bank.
International election observers will return to Guatemala to monitor a court-ordered review of ballots from the nationwide vote last month. This as tension over the review's fairness rises. Reuters' Ryan Brooks reports.
A week after elections in Guatemala vaulted a long-shot candidate to second place in a first round of voting, the country began a review of the votes on Tuesday at the request of the Supreme Court after outcry from the frontrunner, who must now face the unexpected challenger in the next round. The move could potentially make way for a recount before a runoff vote set for next month. Sandra Torres, a former first lady on the center-right who won the first round, has alleged the votes were manipulated. Bernardo Arevalo, who took the surprise second place to Torres, has described her request for a vote review as lacking legal merit and endangering the electoral process. The left-of-center candidate ran on an anti-graft platform at a time when voters are clamoring for a government that can tackle corruption. It's not clear how the court-ordered review might affect the vote next month. Guatemala's Supreme Court has meanwhile said it would suspend election processes in the Central American country until the ballots from the first round are reviewed. The judges have said all complaints must be resolved. The review has sparked concerns from a growing list of countries, including the U.S., which has expressed deep concerns about efforts to interfere with Guatemala's first-round presidential election results. International election observers, meanwhile, are returning to the country to keep a check on the ballot review. The Washington-based Organization of American States took the unusual step of quickly returning its mission to the country following the court order.
That's Ryan Brooks of Reuters reporting. Now, it's no secret that Americans are divided, polarized along many ideological lines. The Associated Press' Jennifer King takes us to two states in the Rocky Mountains where people are voting with their feet.
Conservatives are moving to red states and liberals head to blue as America grows more polarized. Colorado and more conservative Idaho, with opposing state laws on abortion and gender-affirming care, represent two sides of a state-level political divergence on core issues that is getting worse. Former Colorado state lawmaker Rob Whitwer, a Republican, says he's seen the fast-growing Rocky Mountain state transformed by an influx of new liberal-minded residents. Brett Weinstein, a realtor in Denver, says politics has become the top issue for people buying a home. Meanwhile, in Idaho, retired police officer Tim Cole drew compliments from neighbors after raising a thin blue line banner with his U.S. flag, something he says he never felt safe doing in Los Angeles. In all but two states, one party controls the entire legislature. Analysts say some of it is due to last year's Supreme Court decision on abortion, while the pandemic created a mobile workforce that, amid lockdowns and mask mandates, realized how much power state government can wield. I'm Jennifer King.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. U.S. President Joe Biden met with Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson as the White House works to persuade Turkey to approve Sweden's NATO membership ahead of the alliance's summit in Lithuania next week. Chinese state-run Xinhua News Agency says that 15 people have been killed and four others are still missing after torrential rains in southwest China. Digital rights activists say that a recent court ruling in India that dismissed a petition by Twitter challenging the federal government's orders to block tweets and accounts is a setback for free speech. And the UN World Food Program says that Afghanistan is facing a dire humanitarian situation, with 9 out of 10 Afghan families lacking adequate food, and that children and pregnant women are the hardest hit. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Numerous studies have suggested that the loss of a loved one can not only deeply affect you emotionally and psychologically, but physically as well. Researchers from the University of Arizona in Tucson were involved with now completed research on the effect of grief on heart function. A study recently published in the journal Psychosomatic Medicine shows a link between the severity of grief with elevated systolic or upper number blood pressure measurements. The paper also provides evidence that grief can also be a risk factor for cardiac events. In a press release, senior study author Mary Frances O'Connor says that the motive behind conducting the research is the concept of dying of a broken heart, which can happen following the loss of a loved one. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. We visit the place where a reservoir once brought water and life to Ukraine before the Kakhovka Dam was blown up. Now to South Korea, where they've managed to retrieve a North Korean surveillance satellite from the bottom of the sea. Reuters' Gabe Singer tells us what they've learned.
South Korea's military says it believes a recently recovered spy satellite from the North had no real use as a reconnaissance device. The rocket carrying the satellite plunged into the sea off South Korea's west coast in late May after a botched launch. The South was able to salvage parts of the rocket, including the booster, payload, and cylindrical body. South Korea's military said in a statement Wednesday that, quote, "After detailed analysis on major parts of North Korea's space launch vehicle and satellite which were salvaged, South Korean and U.S. experts have assessed that they had no military utility as a reconnaissance satellite at all. They determined the capability of the equipment was poor in terms of resolution and tracing targets." Military experts said it is the first time South Korea has secured a satellite launched by the North. At a key ruling party meeting in June, North Korea described the botched launch as the, quote, "gravest failure." State media said that those deemed responsible for that failure were harshly criticized. It was a rare public admission of a technical problem by Pyongyang, who also vowed to succeed in its orbital quest. In recent months, the North appears to have upgraded its Sohae satellite launch station, potentially for another attempt. The nuclear-armed North has pursued a satellite program since the 1990s. In 2012 and 2016, North Korea launched objects that still remain in orbit. Despite the North's claims, there has been no confirmation they are functioning or transmitting signals.
That's Reuters' Gabe Singer reporting. A month after the explosion at Ukraine's Kakhovka Dam, the upstream reservoir that provided water, power, and food to the region since the 1950s has become a wasteland of dried-up fish carcasses and mud puddles alongside the Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports.
A science fiction writer couldn't make the scene more ominous. A reservoir so vast it was referred to as the sea is nearly dried up. A nuclear power plant manned by an invading army looms over a distant shore as bombs crash into the city almost every day. Locals in Nikopol, Ukraine, fill plastic bottles and buckets with trucked-in water, while Ukrainian officials say that in the hands of the Russian military, the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant could potentially be the site of a disaster. Melania, a resident of Nikopol, gets off her motorbike to check a shop for clean drinking water. The store is sold out. She says she will try to protect her children from nuclear disaster, but mostly she just hopes and waits. But the possible future disaster is not as urgent as the current one, residents say. Besides killing dozens of people and flooding downstream cities, towns, and villages, June's explosion at the Kakhovka Dam that drained the reservoir has cut off almost all the water for the hundreds of thousands of people living on its shores. This is Marina, a resident of Nikopol. Marina says the reservoir drained quickly and people scrambled to find water. She says the local government now trucks in water for drinking, but water for washing is still hard to come by. Further upstream, along the vast muddy desert that was a reservoir, residents say their food crops are dying. 15-year-old Olena says the gardens and fields are drying up and the air smells of dead fish. Her village was, a month ago, home to a national park with birds and other animals. But now it is a barren wasteland, she says. For Olena and others we speak with in this area, the threat of nuclear disaster is too much to even imagine. In 1986, the nuclear explosion near Chernobyl, Ukraine, released 400 times more radioactivity into the atmosphere than the bombing of Hiroshima, Japan in World War II. Hundreds of thousands of people were displaced, and to this day, 2,600 square kilometers of land remains uninhabitable. And while deaths and illnesses were recorded at the time, including an increase in child cancer, the full impact on long-term human health remains unclear. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Nikopol and Malokaterinivka, Ukraine.
A suspicious white powder found in the White House turns out to be cocaine. The AP's Ed Donahue has the details.
Secret Service agents found the powder during a routine White House sweep Sunday in a small, clear plastic bag on the ground.
And they're going to look into what happened this weekend. So the president thinks it is incredibly important to get to the bottom of this.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says President Biden and his family left Friday for Camp David and were not in Washington Sunday. She says where the cocaine was found
is a heavily traveled area where many White House visitors come through this particular area.
Investigators have not yet identified who brought the drugs into the White House.
I'm not going to speculate on who it was.
The Secret Service is combing through White House visitor logs and security footage. Ed Donahue, Washington.
An Australian-based expatriate wanted on national security charges in Hong Kong says that China wants to terrorize its critics overseas into silence. Ted Hui, a former Hong Kong lawmaker, is among eight overseas-based activists wanted on national security charges, including colluding with foreign forces. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has the story.
China's foreign ministry has told Australia to stop sheltering fugitives and stop lending support for anti-China elements. In Canberra, Minister for Foreign Affairs Penny Wong says she has deep concerns over the arrest warrants for two Australia-based Hong Kong democracy campaigners. Beijing accuses them of anti-China activities aimed at destabilizing Hong Kong. Ted Hui is a former member of Hong Kong's parliament and now lives in the Australian city of Adelaide. He and seven other campaigners left the former British territory after China imposed a national security law in 2020 following pro-democracy protests. A bounty of more than $125,000 has been offered on each of the eight activists. Hong Kong's chief executive John Lee has warned that they would be pursued for life. Away told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation Wednesday the arrest warrant wouldn't affect his personal safety and was China's attempt to muzzle dissent overseas.
It's the political gesture that they want to make, and they want to spread this white terror to make all those who are overseas advocating for freedom, democracies, just to shut up and not to criticize them anymore.
The eight pro-democracy activists are based in Australia, the United States and Britain. None have extradition treaties with China. The US State Department said Tuesday China's arrest warrants set a dangerous precedent that threatens the human rights and fundamental freedoms of people all over the world. The sentiments were echoed by Australia. Penny Wong said Monday, freedom of expression and assembly are essential to our democracy, and we will support those in Australia who exercise those rights. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, visit us online at voanews.com and follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The ocean is indispensable to life, producing over half of our oxygen, helping to regulate our climate, absorbing carbon dioxide, and supporting the greatest abundance of life on our planet. Moreover, it is a crucial engine of the global economy. But today, it is in serious trouble. Pollution, overfishing, climate change, and loss of coastal habitats are all damaging the health of the ocean. By protecting the ocean, we protect all life on Earth. And so, protecting the ocean is a top priority of the United States. The work we are doing to protect the oceans is of dramatic importance that will define the future of our planet, said Acting Assistant Secretary for Oceans and International Environmental and Scientific Affairs, Jennifer Littlejohn. To maintain marine sustainability, the United States is working towards ensuring sustainable fishing practices that align with science-based fisheries governance. And that means stopping illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, or IUU fishing, establishing marine protected areas, and addressing plastic pollution. The United States is working to end IUU fishing by collaborating with our partners both in governments and civil society to improve fisheries and ocean governance, support enforcement efforts, enable productive information sharing, and raise ambition to end IUU fishing globally, said Acting Assistant Secretary Littlejohn. At the same time, the United States is advocating for expanding marine protected areas and strengthening their protections, both on the high seas and inside exclusive economic zones. Taking the initiative, we have set a goal to safeguard 30% of the land and coastal waters under our own jurisdiction by the year 2030. To encourage other nations to do the same, we launched the Ocean Conservation Pledge at the Our Ocean Conference in 2022. The pledge commits countries to conserve or protect at least 30% of the ocean under a country's jurisdiction, said Acting Assistant Secretary Littlejohn. Finally, there is the question of plastic pollution, the silent killer of the ocean. The United States is developing its own plan for combating this menace and working with a number of developing countries to build their capacity to make and implement ambitious commitments for the reduction of plastic waste. An important effort will be to involve the private sector and other non-government actors, as we will need innovation and investment to truly address the problem of plastic pollution, said Jennifer Littlejohn. The stakes could not be higher.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.